Yes, I'm speaking today to Lance Compa, who is a senior lecturer at Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations in Ithaca, where he teaches U.S. labor law and international labor rights. He's the author of the Human Rights Watch report, Unfair Advantage, Workers' Freedom of Association in the United States under International Human Rights Standards. Supported by a grant from the Ford Foundation, this report was released in August of 2000 and is available on the Human Rights Watch's website, which is the address is www.hrw.org. Lance is in town to speak tonight at the Committee for New Priorities Forum, which will be on issues of questions of involving the right to organize and how to reinstate it. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, you're welcome. Oops. Okay. My first question would be, I guess, why this report? What circumstances convinced you and the Human Rights Watch people that such a report was needed just now?
Well, you know, traditionally, Human Rights Watch has concentrated its research and reporting efforts on human rights violations in other countries. Mm-hmm. And it's come under some criticism for that, for not looking critically at the United States. And taking that to heart, Human Rights Watch developed a U.S. Human rights program. And in addition to some research and reporting on, for example, prison conditions or the death penalty or the treatment of migrant workers in detention, Human Rights Watch decided in 1998 to make a major commitment to a report on workers' rights violations in the United States under international human rights standards.
Mm-hmm. And why particularly at this time did that seem like an urgent issue? I mean, surely there have been problems involving workers' rights throughout the history of U.S. labor. Why is this a particularly urgent question now?
I think a couple of things drove Human Rights Watch in the direction of looking at workers' rights. One is the apparent decline in the labor movement density, as researchers call it, the mm-hmm. percentage of workers that are represented by unions, and that raises a question of whether this is just an economic phenomenon because of changes in the economy and the structure of industry and the shift to the service economy and so on, or whether there might be something more basic in terms of actual violations of workers' rights or frustrations of workers' rights. That was one thing that drove the decision to undertake this project. The other is the increasing concern in connection with the global economy and global trade and investment about upholding labor standards in international trade. And our listeners may know that the United States has become quite vociferous in recent years in making demands upon other countries to upgrade their labor standards as part of the international trade and investment system. And that poses the question, well, how is the United States doing in terms of its respect for international human rights standards regarding workers?
Both those points, I think, are really important. I was thinking, as you made your first point, there was a PBS program the other night where they were interviewing newspaper reporters about the possible United Pilots strike. And one of the reporters said, just kept saying, well, of course, you know, union membership has been declining over the years, sort of as if no one was particularly interested in organizing. And that was the only reason that numbers were dropping. I think this report obviously brings in an important component of what obstacles might be put in the path of workers who do want to organize. To go to your second point, I noticed in the report that you emphasize again and again, in fact, the discrepancy between the official U.S. policy, particularly in what it demands of global trading partners in terms of human rights, or excuse me, workers' rights questions, and what it practices actually at home. To quote one passage in the report, you write, in recent months, the U.S. government has amplified calls for integrating human rights and labor rights into the global trade and investment system in such venues as the World Trade Organization and the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas. Could you say more about how, why this discrepancy exists? U.S. seems to be stressing this this kind of agreement in its public work out in the global context. Why is it so adamant about not reinforcing workers' rights here at home?
Well, it is something of a contradiction, and I want to be careful about how I address this because I don't think that the Human Rights Watch report should be used to argue that, well, the United States should just drop any calls for integrating workers' rights and human rights into the international trade system. I think that would be a mistake. The point should really be for the United States to make a greater effort to uphold workers' rights in the United States so that it's on a stronger moral foundation, if you will, to raise this issue in various international forums. But I think it's also important to recognize that no country is going to achieve perfection in this area. The truth is that in a market-driven economy where employers have all the rights of property and ownership and management almost universally don't want workers to have unions and to bargain collectively, workers are always going to be in a defensive situation, and countries are going to have to work very hard to enforce workers' rights and protect workers' rights. So I think the point here is that the call should continue to go out for some way of linking workers' rights and the international trade system. But in terms of the United States, I think we're in a better position as Americans to support that kind of a call if we're able to say we have problems too, and all countries have problems in the area of worker rights, and we should work together to find a common solution. I think that's a better approach to the issue than the United States saying, well, we have high standards and we're up here and you other countries, you're down there and you have to come up to our standards. That's just a non-starter. I mean, any country is going to resent that kind of approach. So I think that recognizing that we have serious problems of worker rights violations in the United States is a better starting point for starting to address those problems.
Take care of the issue at home as well as elsewhere, yes. Well, many listeners, and I know I am among them, probably assume or have assumed up to this point that you know, not only was the United States probably leading the way in terms of how it treated its own workers, which of course the report makes clear is not true, but that there were institutions in place in the United States for a good long time that were meant to protect workers' rights, such as the National Labor Relations Board. I was wondering if you could just summarize for listeners what problems are revealed in the report about the effectiveness or lack thereof of the NLRB.
Yes, well, let me make a division between two fundamental problem areas that we found in the report. One is that in some respects, U.S. law, the way the law is written, is in compliance with international human rights standards. For example, it is against the law in the United States to fire workers or otherwise victimize workers because of their union activity. And the NLRB is the agency that's created to enforce that law. Now, I actually have a lot of sympathy for the NLRB and the work that they do. I think the NLRB does the best it can under the circumstances. The problem is the circumstances. The remedies that are available under the law are so weak that they've really lost any deterrent effect. Let me give you some numbers to exemplify what I mean. In the 1950s, the number of workers each year in the United States who suffered some kind of reprisal for union activity was measured in the hundreds, 500, 600, 700 a year. In the 1960s, it began to be measured in the low thousands, 3,000 or 4,000 workers a year. By the end of the 1970s, about 10,000 workers a year were suffering some kind of violation of their rights, and these are official figures. These are figures where workers were found to have been victimized because of their union activity. In 1998, the last year that we have full figures for, 24,000 workers in the United States suffered reprisals, mostly dismissals, mostly losing their jobs, being fired for union activity. Now, it is still illegal under our law. You can ultimately gain a reinstatement order, but the problem is a reinstatement order comes 3 or 4 years down the line, and the only economic liability the employer suffers, suffering is even the wrong word, is to pay back pay minus any income that the worker got in the meantime. There's no punitive damages. There are no fines. There are no other economic penalties. So many employers just make a rational economic calculation that breaking the law is worth it to destroy workers' organizing efforts, because all you have to do 3 or 4 years down the line is offer reinstatement to workers. And by the way, most workers don't accept reinstatement because they've moved on to something else in their lives. And put a notice on the wall saying you won't do it again. And that's just not an effective remedy. And what it means, bringing it back to the international human rights context, is that freedom of association and the right to organize is a fundamental human right under the international human rights system. And governments have a responsibility to effectively enforce the protection of that right. And that's where the United States is falling short.
Yes, I think the point is well taken, that it's a kind of win-win situation for employers, in that they wind up getting rid of the organizing one way or the other, whether they get a good or a bad judgment. I was wondering if you could talk to listeners a bit about what sorts of employment contexts we're talking about here. Is it a particular kind of worker? Are they targeting a particular sort of workplace? Where is the problem?
I think that one of the important findings of our report is that the problem is very widespread, and you really can't say that it's limited to one particular sector or one particular region or one particular type of worker. Human Rights Watch did make a major commitment to this report. I took a year's leave of absence from teaching at Cornell to do the report, and we basically did case studies around the country. And we looked at, for example, computer programmers working for Microsoft in Seattle, Washington. We looked at nursing home workers, nurses and nursing home aides in nursing homes in South Florida. We looked at factory workers in Baltimore and Chicago. We looked at sweatshop workers in Manhattan, shipyard workers in Louisiana, steel workers in Colorado, hotel workers in California. So we really went the full depth and breadth of the economy and the labor force and the labor market, and we found, I regret to say, that the problems appear everywhere. There's no area of the country, and there's no type of worker, there's no particular industry that is not affected by this propensity among many employers. And I should say not all employers. I mean, the record is clear that there are employers who obey the law and respect the right of workers to organize, but obviously too many employers take advantage of the loopholes in the law and the weak remedies and so on to crush workers' efforts to exercise this basic right of association, organizing, and collective bargaining.
Yeah, many of our listeners will remember that about 2 weeks ago we had a rally here in Chicago sponsored by the Chicago Federation of Labor and Jobs with Justice against an organization, a law firm called Jackson Lewis, which basically makes its living teaching corporations how to get around labor law and how to prevent organizing at their workplaces. And it seems pretty clear that it's a sign of the comfort level that corporations have with this kind of behavior that such symposium can take place. Earlier you mentioned that you thought that this phenomenon, that is the rise in complaints and situations in which workers are being harassed on the job and prevented from organizing, had something to do with the general restructuring of the economy and the so-called free market system. Could you say a bit more about the connection between that general trend and the extent to which the U.S. government seems to be turning its back on this situation, or at least ignoring it?
Well, I think that a lot of the problems related to the system, the market system, the system of employer rights and privileges, all the powers that go with the ownership and management of a business, that's accepted as the nature of things, and I think we really have to examine in a critical fashion what does that mean for upholding workers' fundamental rights. For example, and this actually relates to what you were just saying about the consultants who specialize in coaching employers on how to resist their own workers' organizing efforts. Under our legal system, it's unlawful for an employer to directly threaten, for example, to close a plant or close a workplace if the workers form a union. So an employer cannot say, if you vote for a union, I will close the workplace. But the employer can say, if you vote for a union and the union makes excessive demands, I can close the workplace. And that little parenthetical phrase almost of if the union makes excessive demands, now, you know, that raises a whole question. A union obviously is not going to make demands that is going to put the employer out of business. It's a question of collective bargaining and reaching a compromise. But employers are able to use these kinds of technicalities in the law, and the consultants who specialize in these activities are able to teach employers how to make a threat without making it sound like an unlawful threat. In fact, the legal distinction is between a threat, which is unlawful, and a prediction, which is lawful. So an employer can lawfully predict that if a union makes excessive demands that the company can't meet, the company will go out of business. And that's the kind of ledger domain that goes on in these union organizing campaigns that these anti-union consultants really take advantage of.
Well, what do you see, or what would you suggest? I know there are a great many recommendations made in the report about what needs to be done to help counterbalance this situation. You know, clearly unions need to be proactive about it, but also economic justice advocates in other sectors as well.
We do have a series of recommendations, most of which relate to reforming our labor laws to provide for stronger remedies, to provide for stronger protections for workers when they try to organize. For example, employers commonly use the tactic that's called a captive audience meetings to take workers during their work time off of their jobs and bring them into a gathering place where top management basically harangues them about the union and how awful it will be to have a union, and they make these predictions about closing the plant if the union makes excessive demands. And there's no equivalent opportunity for union representatives to speak to workers. They have to hand out leaflets or flyers to workers who are, you know, hurrying in or out of work. Workers can voluntarily go to union meetings, but it's very difficult, especially these days when people are so busy, to get people out to meetings. So one of our recommendations is for equal access for union representatives to also go into the workplace and speak with workers about organizing rights. We also talk about, and this is something I alluded to earlier but didn't get to really flesh out, there are areas of the law itself, as the law is written, that violate international human rights standards. For example, there are widespread exclusions in our labor law, vast categories of workers who are excluded from protection of the right to organize. These include agricultural workers, household domestic workers, independent contractors, low-level supervisors, and when I say low-level supervisors, this includes people who supervise one other person, and maybe the supervisor makes $8 an hour, and the person that she's supervising makes $6 an hour, but because she's a supervisor, she has no protection of the right to organize, and that means that those workers can be fired for trying to organize legally without any, without the employer undergoing any legal liability. Another feature of our labor law, although it doesn't relate to organizing specifically, except it's used as a really powerful threat when workers try to organize, is the power of employers to permanently replace workers who exercise the right to strike. The right to strike is recognized in international law as a basic element of freedom of association. But in our labor law system, employers can permanently replace workers for exercising this right to strike. They can't fire them, but they can permanently replace them. That's the legal distinction that, you know, is used to support that kind of an approach. Many of the workers we talked to who were involved in organizing campaigns said that this was a threat that the employer constantly hammered home at them, that if they vote for a union and the union goes on strike, that they can be permanently replaced. So this is another area of labor law reform that we think is needed. Frankly, labor law reform is probably not on the agenda in the new Congress, the way the new Congress is shaping up, and, you know, however the executive branch turns out, achieving labor law reform is going to be very difficult. So it really is going to fall back to workers themselves, their own strength, their own willingness to take risks, because union organizing in the United States does involve taking a certain amount of risk. But many workers are judging that it's worth the risk to have the fruits of this basic right to associate and to organize and to bargain collectively, And in the last couple of years, there has been some indications that the that there is new organizing going on, that there is a new energy in the labor movement to try to organize, and I think that that will continue, notwithstanding the serious deficiencies in the law that the Human Rights Watch report speaks of.
Great. Well, I want to thank Lance Campa for speaking with us today. He's a senior lecturer at Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations, and was talking today about the Human Rights Watch report that he researched, Unfair Advantage, Workers' Freedom of Association in the United States under International Human Rights Standards, which is available through the Human Rights Watch website. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for the invitation.